Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the fifth program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Our conversation today is about the pillars of democracy. If democracy costs money, who pays? Everyone complains about paying taxes, but what if we really need taxation if we want to have the benefits of democracy? If democracy costs money, who should pay for it? Author Vanessa Williamson argues that some of the most important battles that shape our democracy hinge on one issue, that is taxes. How has that played out in our history, and how is it playing out right now in this very moment? How is it playing out in Maine? This show was pre-recorded on May 11th, 2026. Send your comments to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum. Let me introduce our guests. Garrett Martin is the president and CEO of the Maine Center for Economic Policy. Welcome, Garrett. Thanks for coming back on our show.
Yeah, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Vanessa Williamson is a senior fellow in governance studies at Brookings and a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. She is the author of the book, The Price of Democracy. And you're a veteran of our show, too. Thanks for coming back, Vanessa.
Thank you for having me.
So let's get started. I mean, we want to talk about the premise of your book. So, Vanessa, start us off. Tell us what your book is getting across.
I think it's best to start this conversation. It's a book about the history of taxation and democracy in America, but it's always best to start with a story. Everyone hears the story of the Boston Tea Party, as you're growing up. But what a lot of people don't know is what the colonists were fighting about, right? So the story you have in your mind is correct. It was a winter night in Boston in 1773, and mechanics and artisans went down to Boston Harbor, to Griffin's Wharf, and they boarded three ships, and they threw overboard all these tens of thousands of pounds of tea. And so that story is all true, just the way you heard it, as a kid. But here's the thing you might not have known. The thing that those colonists were mad about was a corporate tax cut. Yeah, if you ask people, they'll tell you, oh, of course, yes, Americans were very mad about taxes being too high. But that's not what drove the Boston Tea Party. See, there was this company, the East India Company, which was a huge corporation, and it was deeply embedded with Parliament, which, sounds familiar today, right? Legislators and corporations closely intermingling. And that company, it basically was the face of Britain in India, right? It was this huge part of the colonial effort there, and it had managed to get itself overextended, right? There was a sort of banking bubble in Europe, and they were out of cash. And so Parliament, of course, decides that when their corporate friends are in trouble, what they need to do is bail them out, right? So they vote for a huge bailout, just a straightforward cash bailout. But as part of that bailout package, they gave the East India Company special tax breaks, specifically the right to sell their tea in the colonies tax-free. And, of course, that meant that their tea was going to be cheaper, right? Colonists could buy a cheaper tea. But they weren't that happy about it because it was going to undercut competition, right? And so Sam Adams, of course, the leader of the Sons of Liberty who organized the Boston Tea Party, he said that this measure was introductive of monopoly and therefore a threat to public freedom. So I tell you this story partly because I really want to spread the word about the true history of the Boston Tea Party, but also just because, I think we've really been sold a line in our sort of casual, mythologized version of American history, and it's told us the wrong story about taxation. Because when you actually look at the history, right, and, and as I try and do in great detail in my book, when you actually look at the history, what you find is that America has not been an anti-tax country, right? In fact, again and again, there have been popular movements to make sure that our democracy was well-funded, because you can imagine, how are you going to enact a democracy if you don't have enough money to spend? And against those efforts to, do things like pay for public schools, for example. Again and again, there's sort of a small group of wealthy elite, often a corporate elite, who are attempting to undermine democracy so that they don't have to pay taxes. And you see this again and again, that anti-tax movements eventually turn into anti-democratic movements. And they're always very well-funded, and they're always a small group of elite who are pushing these issues forward. But what they're trying to do is ensure that either democracy is under their control. That is to say, only the people they want to vote can vote. Or they want to make sure that even if they lose an election, the state is too poor to actually threaten their power, right? Either by investing in public goods or raising taxes on the wealthy. And so these are really two sides of the same coin, the power to tax and the right to vote. And we've been fighting over both of them together throughout our history.
Wow. You're going to comment on that, Garrett?
I mean, amen. You know, I think one thing that's interesting in Vanessa's research is also what groups of people have understood over time the need for taxation and have stood in favor of it versus those who haven't. And she lays that out very clearly just now. But I think the other piece is which taxes are being rendered and how they hit. So, you know, in her book, she writes about the fact, for instance, that tariffs was a primary way of funding our government. Well, that sounds very familiar to some rhetoric we're hearing nowadays. And ultimately, the reason we came to an income tax in this country, once we decided we needed a constitutional amendment to get beyond a Supreme Court that was an activist court and stood in the way of progress this way, that might sound familiar too. You know, there was the move to go towards an income tax because a lot of working people, and here in Maine, that was, you know, that was loggers and farmers, understood that we needed that form of taxation over the sales tax and the tariffs that they were facing that were actually raising the cost of the things that they produced and making them less widely available. So yeah, I think that's my hot take as a student of Vanessa's.
I mean, we've got some stuff going on right now, from the framing of the Constitution to the decades-long backlash to the civil rights movement. Connect those dots for us, because we're seeing some of that decades-long backlash to the civil rights movement playing out right before our very eyes.
So I'll talk about that. I also just want to say, I mean, when I was writing this book, there were chapters I knew were going to be relevant. And one of them was about, you know, for example, the period of Cultural Reconstruction, right? There's this radical period after the Civil War when briefly the American government defended multiracial democracy in the South. And the Southern states, you see, for the first time Black men can vote. They run for office in states like South Carolina that were majority Black. The legislature was majority Black, right? And so what are these governments trying to do? They're trying to build public schools for the first time, not just for Black students, for any students, right? The public school system in the South was very, very weak before the Civil War. And so they're trying to build these public school systems. So they need money. They want to raise taxes. And they also want to raise taxes on the very wealthy, right? The people who had enslaved them until recently. And so they're trying to raise taxes on land, and especially unused land, so that they have the money they need to build these schools, right? The backlash that came to Reconstruction would sound so familiar today. It's exactly the kind of backlash we've heard since the second Reconstruction, the Civil Rights Movement, when once again, you have the same sort of rhetoric of, oh, there are, the government is full of people who can't be trusted. There are lazy people taking advantage of government services, hardworking taxpayers. And, you know, there's always sort of wrapped up in the racialized rhetoric, right? So the hardworking taxpayer, the hardworking white taxpayer, and the beneficiaries of government are presumed to be Black, right? So there's this sort of racialized racist rhetoric around this. And so you see that in Reconstruction, the first time we tried to have multiracial democracy in America, and you see it in the backlash to the second Reconstruction that we've all been living in for decades. And I mean, you know, the overturning of the Voting Rights Act, is, you know, just, I think, further evidence that we are fighting fights we've been fighting a long time now. So I saw that coming. I saw that fact I was going to be talking about Reconstruction as I was writing the book. I was like, this feels really relevant. You know, some of the things the opponents of Reconstruction said sounded like they came out of Ronald Reagan's mouth. But I'll tell you what I did not foresee was the tariffs. I wrote the tariff chapter. I was like, I got to write the tariff chapter. You know, I mean, they used to fund the federal government that way. It was such a big part of our fiscal history. I've got to write this story. And then the book comes out and we're doing tariffs again, like the Gilded Age, you know? But yeah, that's exactly right, what Garrett was saying. The tariffs fell heavily on working people, right? They fall heavily on consumers. They did then, they do now. And people knew that. They weren't fools. And so that was a big part of the mobilization that it took to get our Senate income tax.
And if I can just chime in on this, I mean, I think what's so interesting in this analysis is again, what we talk about a lot is how groups are pitted against each other, oftentimes groups who have a shared economic interest to the benefit not of anyone in that particular group, the larger group, but to the benefit of people sort of higher up in the income chain. And I think here again, there's some interesting historic precedent for Maine, which is when Maine sought to ratify the 16th Amendment, which is what put an income tax in place at the federal level, the initial push at the state level was to say, well, wait a second, we shouldn't do this. What we should do is have a state income tax. And one of the arguments against going along with the federal income tax, and this is recorded by Paul Mills, who is actually the brother of a current governor and a student of history. He writes a piece talking about the House taxation chair at the time, who was a Waterville Democrat. And what he says is that the reason for not going along with the federal tax is that it would rob eastern states, such as Maine, of their tax money in order to install irrigation schemes costing millions, and that Maine's tax money would be sent out west to be taken up by speculators who hardly gave us a chance to say goodbye to it. That was done ultimately in a way that wasn't going to benefit anybody in Maine, but it was going to benefit the wealthy elites in the eastern seaboard, like J.D. Rockefeller and others who stood in the way of those that progress. So it is just interesting to see the echo reverberate on these debates. In Maine, it wasn't, you know, as much around some of the racial animus as you saw in the South, but similar sort of constructs of let's pit people against each other who are at similar economic levels in order to allow this wealthy elite to retain their power and privilege over sort of that democratic mass who might strive to take it away if given the chance to do so and the means to do so, which is fundamentally what Vanessa's talking about.
So, I mean, I think the League of Women Voters probably supported the income tax in Maine. And I guess I've probably always thought that progressive income tax was, you know, one of the ways that we create a fair democracy. But are you saying it was different when the fight came to Maine in the first place, Garrett?
Well, when the fight came to Maine initially, it was in the context of passage of the 16th Amendment in 1910. And so what the House lawmakers in the Maine State House at the time said, wait a second, let's not do this. Let's pass a state income tax. That's better for us so that we're not sending our money elsewhere. That was really what was happening then. And eventually it was the Senate side of the legislature that said, wait a second, we should go ahead and approve this because there actually may be some benefit. And interestingly enough, right, part of the argument early on in early days was, oh, we're sending our money away. Well, if you look at where we are currently, for every dollar we send out of state in federal taxes, we get $1.68 back. So we're net receivers of those resources that are crafted by the federal tax code. And if you look at Maine's economy and what's made possible in the state, I mean, 80% of our funding for highways and bridges, for instance, is federal sources. And so when you see the continued efforts to reduce those resources available to states over time, particularly over the last 50 years, well, of course, you're then undercutting the capacity of states to actually do good things for their own citizens, especially states that are potentially poorer states and have less resource and capacity to raise those resources. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. It's an interesting through line.
What does this have to do with voter suppression and gerrymandering and trying to, you know, keep people from participating in representative democracy?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about how it worked in the South first time. You see examples of this in other places, actually, but I'll tell the Southern story first because it's sort of the most extreme. So, as I said at the start, every now and again in our history, there's been sort of a group of wealthy people, and not all wealthy people by any stretch of the imagination, but a certain number of people who want to think of themselves, the way I put it usually is, they want to see themselves as masters, not as citizens. They don't want to live under a democracy fundamentally, right? They want to be the sort of captain of their ship, and they're very rich and powerful, and they find something really grating about the idea that any aspect of that would, you know, fall under the rule of law, and especially under the rule of law in a democracy decided by a lot of people who they don't see as their equals fundamentally, right? So the first group of people who felt that way were Southern slave owners. They literally saw themselves as masters, and they did not think that, you know, they wanted any part of the government coming onto their land and assessing their property because they wanted to have their power be seen as absolute, right? And so there, in the Constitution, when we were writing the Constitution, they fought again and again, Southern slave owners, to limit the power of the federal government to tax. Because even though the federal government was, you know, was going to be elected exclusively by property of white men at the start, but most property of white men weren't slave owners, right? And so they were worried that small farmers, you know, from places like Maine, right, would want to raise taxes on slavery, and it would result in abolition. So they were afraid of that. So they put all these tax limitations in our federal constitution, which, by the way, did not end with the Civil War. They are still there today. They put all these tax limitations in our constitution to prevent the federal government from having a lot of power. And it was sort of a two-part system, right? Because on the one hand, they put in place these tax limitations. On the other hand, of course, they demanded the three-fifths clause, right? And they wanted, in fact, well, they demanded more. They demanded the five-fifths clause, right? Where they would get all of this extra representation instead of just three-fifths of the enslaved population counting for the purposes of representation, it would have been five-fifths. That's what they were seeking. And so what that meant, of course, was that their states got to count population that were not allowed to participate in the political process. And it gave the South a boost in its representation right up till the Civil War. And so this is the two prongs of the strategy, right? If you don't really want to live under democracy and you're very, very well off, on the one hand, you try and change the voting. So three-fifths clause, classic example of that. On the other hand, you try and make sure that even if your protections against one man, one vote fail in some way, then you've got this backup, which is that the government doesn't have the power to tax you. The government's power to tax is hampered. And you see this again. You see this during Reconstruction. You see it during Jim Crow, that the Southern states, as they cease to be democracies, right, as they become authoritarian enclaves within the United States with a one-party rule by the Democrats, they also put in place these very, very stringent limitations on the power of the state to tax, right? This is where the sort of property tax limitations, the constitutional tax limitations that a lot of states have today first came from. The innovators were the Jim Crow governments, right? And it's only in the aftermath to the Civil Rights Movement that we see those spread to places like my home state of California and lots of other states, Massachusetts as well. And so what you find is this two-part endeavor, right, to make sure, one, that you control the government, right, that you choose the voters don't choose you, right, that's always the authoritarian preference. And so one, you manipulate the election, right, you manipulate it either through gerrymandering, you can do that through poll taxes, you can do that through all kinds of mechanisms, you know, outright violence, of course, in the Reconstruction period. There are a lot of different mechanisms used to disenfranchise in this country's history. But alongside that, you always have the second mechanism, that in case you lose, in case those protections aren't strong enough to keep the majority of the public from having power of the purse, well, we'll make sure that the taxes are too low, and the taxes are too limited, especially where they touch rich people, so that taxes are always a little bit more aggressive and revenues are always a little bit lower, and the very wealthy can protect themselves against the tax preferences of the majority of the public.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is Democracy Costs Money. Who Pays? Our guests this afternoon are Vanessa Williamson, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at Brookings and Senior Fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, and Garrett Martin, President and CEO of the Maine Center for Economic Policy. This program was pre-recorded on May 11th. No listener calls are being taken. So people's attitudes towards taxes. I mean, Pew says that people don't mind paying taxes and that they think following the law and paying taxes is part of being a good citizen. I mean, but all the time we hear people hate paying taxes, you know, grumbling about paying taxes. Nobody likes taxes. So what's the truth here about people's attitude toward paying taxes?
So I think there are two things going on, right? First of all, people are frustrated by the tax system. That is certainly true. If you ask them what bothers you most, Gallup asks this every year and has asked for many, many years, and is always the same every single year. They put out the data. It looks like last year. What bothers you most about the tax system? The number one and number two answers are always that the feeling that corporations, one, and the wealthy, two, aren't paying their fair share. Number three is always complexity. Very fair concern. We have an extraordinarily complex tax code at a federal level, certainly, and in many states. Those are the things people bother people most, more every single year than the amount they personally pay. The feeling that someone else isn't doing their part, right? That takes away from your feeling of pride, right? If you're doing your job and you're proud of the work you do, but then you look over and someone else isn't doing their part, that it's not that you don't feel pride in your work anymore, but you're frustrated, right? And so I think that's the same feeling people have with the tax system. You know, that they see taxation as a patriotic responsibility, a civic duty. This is an absolutely consensus opinion among the American people. If you ask people, is it every American's civic duty to pay their fair share of taxes, you will get somewhere between 90 and 95% of Americans saying yes. When I first saw this, I tried to find survey data that was equivalently high, right? where, I mean, because when do you see 90 or 95% of people agreeing? The answer is, if you ask them, did the moon landing happen or is Elvis alive? These are the kind of questions you have to ask until you get, you know, 90, 95% of Americans agreeing. So yeah, so Americans really do see this as a responsibility, but they know that someone else isn't taking their responsibility seriously. And that's very frustrating. It should be.
Yeah. And, you know, we've done some polling here in Maine over the years, and based on data from our most recent poll, for instance, 61% of Mainers want the wealthy and large corporations to pay more in taxes. And that's a 10 percentage point increase since 2014. So, you know, I think this phenomenon of people appreciating that we're doing our job here, we're helping to fund the services and the programs that we care about, we're actually kind of starting to get a little frustrated that things, for instance, like mail service is degrading and our roads are actually not as good as they once were. And the cost of higher ed, which used to be better supported through public funding, is now getting to the point where it's completely inaccessible for a typical family. But they're also looking around, they're saying, wait a second, we're starting to understand, you know, there was a lot of talk a few years ago about the Warren Buffett phenomenon where he paid less in taxes than his secretary. Well, now you've got, you know, large corporations like Tesla running around, which paid no corporate taxes last year. And I think public awareness around these issues has definitely grown, in part because it's gotten so grossly out of step with where we ought to be in terms of how we're raising revenue and who's actually paying, that it's just inevitable that people are going to tap into that sensibility.
Well, I sort of want to ask about whether the Reagan administration was a turning point in people's attitude towards taxation and people's attitude toward government and government provided services. What do you think about that, Vanessa?
I think that's really interesting, is that Reagan is really a turning point in the politics of taxation, right? So, I mean, Reagan himself was incredibly consistent over his entire life. He starts his political career, I mean, he's an actor at first, of course, and he jumpstarts his political career in, like, his first major public national thing was supporting Goldwater. Goldwater, who had opposed the Civil Rights Act and, you know, who was sort of seen at the time as really far right compared to the sort of range of politics that was typical in the sort of 50s and 60s era. Well, by the 70s and 80s, that sort of more conservative rhetoric had become much more common. And Reagan, who had been seen very much as an extreme outlier, had become a much more mainstream figure. Now, his rhetoric never changes on this, right? But he's always talking about the same sort of thing. Like, you know, he famously talked about the welfare queen, right? The story he's told over and over again. He told the story, by the way, long after the poor woman had who had been caught, you know, engaging in welfare fraud had been caught, had served her time, you know, and he was always making up new numbers. You know, the number of accounts she had and the amount of money she got always tax-free, he would say, was growing in every speech, you know. He adopted very early on a kind of rhetoric that was the anti-government rhetoric, and it was out of step with the public for a time, for a long time. But then by the late 70s, one, you see wealth start to consolidate, right? Also, you begin to see the power of unions decline, right? So working people's voices in government starts to decline right at the time that the business voice in government gets larger. And, you know, it is always true that the wealthy and corporations are trying to avoid taxation. That's the absolute perennial of American politics. And so Reagan sort of comes to power in that moment when you start to see those mechanisms intersect with the backlash to the civil rights movement, right? When you start to see the kind of anti-tax rhetoric that was really a criticism of the capacity of the government to do things, which is at its core often not just a criticism of, you know, inefficiency or something, but an idea that government can't work, right? Not that government isn't working, let's improve it, let's invest where we need to invest and save money where we can save money. No, the idea that government is the problem in itself, right? Because the idea is that decisions made by the public aren't valid decisions, right? And the time when that kind of rhetoric starts to sell, right, when they manage to convince us that our democracy, not just that it doesn't work, but that it can't work, that kind of rhetoric unfortunately gets a big helping hand from racial resentment. When it's after we see the range of voters increase to include our entire democracy, right? You know, the United States is a very old republic, but we are a very young democracy. We've only been a democracy since 1965. And it's in the backlash to that that you find this anti-tax rhetoric arise. And then, you know, Reagan really finds his moment after many decades of having provided very similar analyses of whether government was working.
Well, I think the other piece of this, Anne, is what's so interesting here is, first of all, the pressure to reduce taxes, for instance, on the top is ever present. And So you look back in our history, you know, our top tax rate at one point in time was 94%, right? That was in the 1940s, and it was ostensibly to fund war. But one of the things I have talked about with other groups around the state is sort of, if you look at our tax rates over time and you overlay it with measures of inequality, there's sort of inverse relationship. So as our tax rates drop, inequality has gone up. And that's just a reflection of a broader challenge here. But what really, I think, in my view, started to happen under Reagan is the fundamental understanding of how we grow our economy and how we invest in our people to do that changed. And a lot of that has to do, again, with what happened in the tax code. So pre-Reagan, you know, when corporations were profitable, if you were a shareholder, you relied on things like dividends to sort of benefit you. Well, now what do? They rely on stock buybacks, right? To inflate the price of the stock over time. That is structured, that's baked into our tax code, that incentive structure. So what does it mean now that we've done that? Well, it means that rather than invest their profits back into their workers or into capital improvements for their businesses, they're more and more firms are using those dollars to just pump up the value of their stock because that's in the best interest of the shareholders, of the CEOs, of the board. And so, you know, a great example of this is if you look at Lowe's, for instance, the amount of money they've spent on stock buybacks in the last 5 years, if they had used that money to boost worker salaries of the 270,000 workers in their businesses, they could raise the average wage by $30,000 a year for those workers. So you can see this phenomenon of workers being left behind and greater consolidation of wealth that is completely baked into our tax code and was sold and rendered in part through this sort of racialized pitting and class pitting that we saw during that time. So,
and how much of that is getting boosted right now by sort of an active demolition of government capacity to provide vital services? I mean, we're just reading about FEMA, you know, cutting back services to certain states. So how much of that is, well, and the Postal Service, as you talked about, Garrett, how much of that is eroding people's confidence in government's ability to actually do the stuff that people want?
Yeah, well, this is one thing I really like about living in Maine is that people, because of our, you know, local control and town government set of governance, it means that voters are engaged at a local level, determining what level of service do we want. And so there is an understood connection that if we cut back on the resources we have available locally to do things like plow our roads, you know, to provide public safety, we know what that means. We see what that translates. I think we start to lose sight of that the further away from us it gets. And as I've shared, you know, with you before, Anne, one of my favorite memes is "There goes that socialist snowplow." you know, so I do think, though, that there is sort of designed to failed elements baked into that structure where if you can undercut the ability of government to do its job, then you no longer have a strong case for needing the resources to fund government to do its job. And you create this sort of self-perpetuating cycle where you're diminishing the value of the services, the disinvestment phenomenon, right? And then reapportioning those resources up the income ladder. And again, I think the best example in my mind for typical households is think about how much families had to pay as a share of their income to send a kid to college 50, 60, 70 years ago. It was a heck of a lot less than it is today. And that is completely tied to public disinvestment in that is a good that should be broadly available to, you know, a broader segment of the population.
Do you want to comment on that, Vanessa, the destruction?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I live in Washington, D.C. And so the destruction to the federal government that occurred in the last year is very personal for a lot of families here, but not just here, right? Because, you know, there's this politicians run to go to Washington by running against Washington, classically, right? So they make fun and they insult my town, which is a town of 700,000 people and a wonderful place to visit. We have beautiful parks and museums. You should come visit us. We are your nation's capital and we love you all. I don't know why so many of you keep sending your crazy people to us. Here's the thing. The federal government saw huge cutbacks this year, huge, incredibly irresponsible cutbacks on all kinds of things that Americans really care about, right? And I think that one thing that happens when you discover that, oh, you accidentally cut, for example, the people who check on our nuclear silos. Well, those same people are really, really important. The people who pay, the grants that fund cancer research. Yeah, you know what? That really counts for something, right? They're all the people in food safety. All of these people doing jobs that are sort of imagined to occur in Washington, D.C. and actually happen all over the country, that are really important things we all care about, right? But I think what we saw in a way was, you know, we harvested the fruit of that anti-government rhetoric, right? We spent decades saying that government couldn't work and didn't work. And then it was a real shock to discover that if you suddenly cut a quarter of the staff of a major federal agency, a lot of important stuff doesn't get done. It is my hope that that kind of rhetoric can be eased out of our politics, because it's factually wrong, which is reason enough, but it's also it's a really toxic way of pitting people against one another, right? You know, in the same way that this, I love the socialist snowplows. I think that's exactly right. But you know, when we talk about those government workers, I mean, they're actually these are people doing important work. Right. If you want, for example, corporations to pay taxes, yeah, there's someone at the IRS who's actually there trying to do that job. If you want your food to be safe, you want food safety inspectors. And so I think that, you know, one thing I would love to see going forward is that we can bring a little bit of that local, that thing that we have locally, right, where we know what our government does, we can bring that to a national level and have a little bit more investment and a little bit more faith in our national democracy. Because just like Garrett said about the, an income tax for Maine instead of a national income tax, totally in favor of both, of course. But the thing about a national income tax is that was what was going to reach J.D. Rockefeller, right? Yeah. The richest man in the world at the time, right? And so some of these things, it's great to do things at a local level, but some things we can only get the resources together if we do them nationally. And I hope that we can bring a little more of that spirit that you guys have in your towns to the nation as a whole.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Garrett Martin, President and CEO of the Maine Center for Economic Policy, and Vanessa Williamson, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at Brookings, and also Senior Fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Our topic today is about the pillars of democracy. Democracy costs money. Who pays? This show was pre-recorded. You can send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. Garrett, what were you about to say?
And where this really comes home to roost in my mind is when the strategy to disinvest in government and convince people that government doesn't actually work is what happens then when there is an actual failure that is a result of government not being able to do its job. And then all of a sudden, government's to blame. It's this sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of phenomenon. And I think we've seen that play out in a couple of spaces over, you know, several years. You know, one is the financial collapse in 2008 and sort of the failure to oversee and properly regulate those large financial institutions. You see that currently, you know, again, the post office is a great example that I think a lot of people can relate to. You see that in the IRS, as Vanessa alluded to. You know, a lot of the cutbacks that happen, there are fewer people now there actually in position to go after corporate tax cheats. And as a consequence, we're losing close to almost $1 trillion a year from revenue that we might have otherwise obtained had we appropriately staffed that agency. Now, if we had that money, that would be more than enough, for instance, to fund universal childcare throughout the country. So then we do that, we sort of undercut government's ability to do its work. And then we say, oh, so we need to put less guardrails on the private sector because they're actually the solution. And so, you know, then all of a sudden Medicare drug costs and plans go through the roof and nobody's protecting grandma from the bad plan she got that was offered by a private entity because we outsourced that. And it turns out it's not the plan that meets her needs, but it sure is profitable to the people who are offering it. You have that interplay again between the disinvestment, which then undermines the capacity to do the job effectively, which then creates a scenario in which, you know, these private actors have sort of free rein. And along the way, they're enriching themselves more and more and more. And so this, again, this tension and this inequality. But again, it all comes back to the tax code, because the tax code is where we raise the resources to make the investments to ensure that those opportunities are available and that we're not privatizing those costs onto individual households and families. And the tax code is where we help set the rules of the game so that how we are honoring people's work versus people's wealth is part of the equation. So, you know, one of the things I'm continually struck by is if you take a household that's earning $150,000 a year, a married couple, if they're earning that money from work, they're paying roughly $28,000 a year in payroll and income taxes. If that money comes from wealth, which means they have a big enough portfolio that they're raking in capital gains, they're only paying about $4,000 a year in taxes. And if that money comes from inheritance, they're paying nothing, mm-hmm. right? So I think most people on the street would be like, wait, that seems like the opposite of what we should be doing. That seems like the exact, at the very least, we should all be paying the same. And there are all kinds of ways in which that dynamic is being exploited by, for instance, people who structure their compensation to be in the form of capital gains. So they're foregoing having to pay income tax in the same way that people who are working do. So I think this is all, you know, that's the sort of intersection that we're dealing with here. But what's so fascinating again about Vanessa's work is she really helps us appreciate that there's a through line to this conversation. So, you know, we've been here before in some respects, and we've demonstrated our capacity when enough people understand both what they want to see from their government and the need to ensure that we're funding it appropriately and fairly, that we can come together and push back against all the billions and billions of dollars that are being funneled in to enrich a few at the expense of the many.
Okay, so it was just announced this week that the national debt now exceeds the GDP. And I'm not sure what the debt to GDP ratio actually means, but why should we be concerned? Does this indicate that we're not collecting enough tax revenue and that sort of minority rule is siphoning off? What? I'm not sure. Vanessa, what do you think?
I think it's important to think of it not just about how much we're spending, but if we're spending it on the right things.
Yep.
And I think there are situations, I mean, for example, we had a debt to GDP ratio like this during World War II. That was money well spent, right? Winning World War II. Couldn't really speak more highly of a policy choice that the United States has made. But I'm asking myself, thinking about how we're spending at a similar rate, what are we spending it on? What are we getting? Are we defeating Nazism? I don't think so. To me, more than what the ratio is, what matters is, are we investing wisely, right? And you can think of this, I mean, the federal budget is not like a household budget, right? Because the federal government prints money, which is special and not at all like being a homeowner. But, I mean, in some ways, I think you can make that analogy, right? And sometimes you take on debt because you did something that was worth doing. You were growing your business, you bought a home, you know, and you normally can't pay for those things outright. So you take on debt, and that's maybe good debt to have taken on because it's a good, solid investment you've made. But if you're just going out, like running up the credit cards because you're gambling, well, now you made a terrible mistake. And I think, unfortunately, our policy looks a lot more like that second thing than it should. So, you know, looking forward, also, it constrains our choices, right? That's the other problem. You know, if we were, speaking for myself, I'd say, if we were putting in the investments we need so that climate change stopped, wow, that would be worth it. I don't want to leave that my children with the climate debt, right? So I'd be willing to take on some debt now for our government. But, you know, the thing we need to be thinking about going forward is when we have more debt, we have more interest payments, and that's money we're not spending on the other stuff we want to do, right? And I think, you know, we're not getting what we should from our money. We spend more in the United States on healthcare than any other major country in the world, but our health outcomes are worse, right? How is it that we spend so much money and get so little in return? How is it that every other, you know, industrialized nation is seeing their life expectancies get longer, and the United States, they're just not anymore? What is that? Well, I mean, it's easy to understand, right? We put our money for healthcare through this Rube Goldberg device of private agencies, right? And profit making, you know, wealthy CEOs from health insurers, and all throughout the healthcare system, and you don't end up with the public health outcomes that you want, right? So to me, it's more a question of how to spend the money than any particular statistic you see on a particular day.
And, you know, Anne, on this, the reality is, in this country, we do good things when we do them together, like the funding the war effort for World War II. I also think this idea of the debt figure, again, is being used as an excuse for why we need to cut taxes for some bizarre reason, right? And the best example I can give of the flawed logic in, again, how our tax system is being structured and what's happening for people who really rely on these services is look at the conversation around Social Security and the idea that it's going to become insolvent and therefore we need to change our benefit structure and, you know, all these other things. Okay, so you're looking at a problem that you've defined based on the outflow of money. How about we look at the current structure of what the inflow looks like? And it turns out that the inflow is curtailed. It's capped because we're not actually applying the payroll tax that's funding Social Security to all wage income. We're only applying it to a certain level of wage income. So if you're really rich, you're not contributing your fair share. Also, if you're one of these people who has structured your benefits package to come from capital unearned or capital gains, again, you're not contributing at all. So if we change the conversation from, oh, we don't have enough, that sort of scarcity mentality, to a conversation about what's the best version of ourselves? What could we do? What are the great things we could actually be doing? And what would it take to raise the resources to make that happen? There's a lot of resources out there on the table. And in the same way that Vanessa talks about, we should be talking about where we're spending the money and to what end, we should also be talking about how we're raising the money and to what end.
Well, I mean, when I read that statistic, what I was thinking is we've cut taxes too far. Like, we're not raising enough taxes. And where have we cut taxes? We've cut taxes on rich people. So my Anne's interpretation of nothing, that we should be taxing rich people a lot more than we are. So I was coming around to asking you, is progressive taxation like a thing of the past, or can we reconstitute? And to what extent do rich people in America bear a level of responsibility for preserving democracy? What do you think about that, Vanessa?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, people should know that America is a low tax country. We complain, there's a lot of talk about taxes in this country, but taxes are in fact low in the United States by international standards. And that's the limitation that makes it hard for us to do things like provide universal health care, universal child care, right? Which, you know, other countries do provide because they raise more money through the revenue system than we do. And one of the things you'll see if you look internationally is that the highest tax countries are the freest countries. They are the most democratic countries by international standards. That's because taxation and representation really do go together. They go together historically. We developed taxation and representation at the same time, right? Because people like King John wanted more tax revenue, and so they agreed to a certain amount of limitations on their power and to consult with barons and lords back in 1215, right? This is Magna Carta. We develop a system of taxation that develops a system of representation. And the interesting thing is that after we develop a system of representation, what is today called the British Parliament, taxes go up, not down. Why do they go up? Because once people are consulted about the revenue the government's raising, they actually want to raise more revenue because they have some really great ideas about what to do with that money, right? So what you find is that taxation and representation develop together historically. They correlate together internationally. Democratic countries are high tax countries. Autocracies are not. Autocracies are typically low tax countries, right? And we've always been an outlier in that way. But of course, the quality of our democracy has declined in a way that actually is what you would anticipate looking at our tax revenue. So yeah, I think it's critically important that we raise tax revenue. And of course, we remain an incredibly wealthy country with very many extraordinarily rich people, and they've gotten far richer in recent decades. You know, we're really back in a new golden age. So that is absolutely a major source of the revenue we should be collecting. But I'll tell you, you know, and most Americans understand this, it's not, taxation isn't a punishment, it's a responsibility. And it's absolutely the case that wealthy people bear a larger responsibility because they have more money. But it's all of our responsibilities, and we all chip in. So I think sometimes when we think exclusively about the progressivity of our tax system, we forget about how much revenue we need overall and the fact that everyone's chipping in, right? We think about our income tax, which needs to become more progressive, but we also need to remember that those payroll taxes, sales taxes, gas taxes, all those other kinds of taxes, everyone's paying, everyone's chipping in. So it's critically important that we're thinking both about the slope of the line, right? That we wanted to get steeper at the top because wealthy people can afford to pay. And because frankly, the level of wealth we're seeing in this country is incompatible with democracy, right? Because money is power. But we also need to remember, you know, it's not just the slope, it's also the height of the line, because we need to be raising enough revenue that that we can afford the priorities that we care about.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I think the other reason why this matters is the tax code and the way we currently do it. So talk about the affordability crisis. Well, part of the reason why cost of living has gone up for so many people is because, again, we have these sort of markets run amok. We have this disinvestment in things that people need that would make their lives better. And then we have a tax code that sort of further propagates that. So, you know, the typical American consumer at this point is paying $1,600, in Maine, at least, is paying $1,600 a year more in cost on account of the tariffs. Look at the oil companies right now. The last time we had a moment like this where gas prices ran up this high was after Russia invaded Ukraine, and oil companies reported over $600 billion in additional profits. Those are windfall profits. That is money being extracted from consumers to the benefit of those corporations and their CEOs. We had a rally a year ago on tax day, and a couple showed up with a great sign that still I keep near and dear to me, which is tax the rich. They'll still be rich. There are people in our history. You know, Adam Smith, interestingly enough, was for progressive taxation. I've heard Vanessa give this factoid. You know, Thomas Paine, you want to do this one, Vanessa?
Well, wait, I got to take a quick station break before you get into that. Okay. Democracy Forum on WERUFM. This is Ann Luther of the League of Women Voters. Our guests this afternoon are Garrett Martin, President and CEO of the Maine Center for Economic Policy, and Vanessa Williamson, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at Brookings. This show is pre-recorded on May 11th. No listener calls are being taken. Take it away, Vanessa.
So before I tell you about Tom Paine's tax plan, I want to make sure we're all on the same page about something. Probably everyone listening to this would be, but so a lot of Americans are confused about this. Like, when you hear that our top income tax rate was once 94%, that didn't mean they were taking 94% of anyone's money. That's not what it meant. It's a surcharge, is how you can think of it, on the part of your income that's in that very top bracket. You know, if you have millions and millions of dollars, you're paying the same rate as everyone else on the first, you know, $10,000, $20,000. They pay the same rate as everyone else all the way up the brackets until you get to those top brackets, right? So that idea is called marginal taxation. And once upon a time, it was completely new. In fact, it had to be invented, and it was invented around the time that Tom Paine was living. So Tom Paine, you'll all remember, you probably all had to read Common Sense at school. Yeah, this was the pamphlet that in 1776 made the case not just that America should be an independent country, but that we should be a republic, that America didn't need a king, right? So it was very radical at the time, and it changed the course of history fundamentally. So Tom Paine was this very radical guy. He was an abolitionist, and he, after, you know, being the pen of the American Revolution, he went off to England and to France to participate in some more revolutions, right? And so later, he wrote something called The Rights of Man. This was mostly, you know, it's mostly remembered now as a beautiful defense of the principles of the French Revolution. But in it, he included a tax plan. And this tax plan had the idea of marginal taxation in it. Now, he makes a few math errors, to be completely honest, but if I had to work with shillings, I too would get confused. But the basic idea is a really great one. Like our tax system today, it starts with a zero rate, and then the rates go up on the income in the next bracket, right?
I see.
And so the brackets went up, and they started at zero. They rose slowly, but then they went up very high at the top, at a level that no one in America at the time had. Only, you know, the Duke of such and such or the Earl of whatever would have had that much money even back then. But it was the equivalent of about $1 billion today in wealth, right? The income from about $1 billion. And the top rate that Tom Paine proposed was 100%. Not merely 94, 100%, because Tom Paine argued he was worried about corruption in elections. That's what he says. And he wanted to ensure that even if you have a republic, if some people are simply so rich that they can buy seats, that isn't a real democracy, right? And so he wanted to protect the sanctity of elections. And he thought, you know, there's a level of wealth beyond what any man can earn, right? Beyond what anyone could possibly need to raise a family. And at that level, when it gets so high that it threatens the safety of our elections, the, you know, sort of free and fair nature of our democracy, at that point, it's too much money. And so, yeah, he thought there should be a limit to property. So if you're thinking about, you know, some tax proposal you've heard lately, and is it really radical? And no, it wasn't. Tom Paine outstripped everyone with the radicalism of his plan. But I think the spirit of it is exactly right. We all know today, you know, he was prescient, but we all know today that you can, that a lot of our politics is bought and sold, right? And a lot of the danger of that is people simply have too much money. Yeah. You know, I can say here in Washington, D.C., we used to have a really wonderful paper, you probably heard of it, the Washington Post, that lost a quarter of its staff. And that was one man's decision. as a national paper. And so I think, you know, we're just in, there is a problem when people can buy and sell essential institutions of our democracy.
And to that point, the Washington Post, you know, for campaign finance folks, for instance, you want to get money out of politics. But if you still have billionaires who are buying up newspapers and controlling other means of communicating with people, they're still going to have the power that they have. And just point of fact on the when at our highest top tax rate of 94%, that kicked in at today's equivalent of $3.5 million, basically.
In income. Not in,
in income. Yeah. So, you know, but it wasn't you paid 94% on your $3.51, not the $3.5 million below it, just that $1 above it. Right. And I do think Vanessa's right. Like people sort of lose sight. But the Washington Post is a great example here in terms of tax fairness and the fight for tax fairness, because, first of all, Jeff Bezos, to go back to sort of how our tax code has been rigged in all these crazy ways, he claimed $82,000 in income a few years ago and qualified for the earned income tax credit for his family.
No way.
Which is just mind-boggling, right? But the other piece is, I'm proud to say, in Maine, we've made really good progress in having a tax system that is more fair than most states. Most state systems are hugely regressive, particularly states that don't have income tax. What that means is the less income you have, the more you pay in taxes as a share of your income relative to everybody else. In Maine, we actually, in part, and this is partially Maine Center for Economic Policy, it's like our core work. We passed a threshold about 6 years ago where the bottom 40% in the state no longer paid more as a share of their income than the top 1%. But the most recent victory we've had, right, is the passage of the millionaire's tax. So again, let's be clear, it's on a year's, someone who is earning $1 million or more a year in income is paying 2% more on that next dollar, right? So you're paying on that $1,001,000, you're paying 2 cents more on that extra dollar above $1 million. But the Washington Post panned it in two separate op-eds editorials. And did they publish our response, lifting up the fact that a majority of Mainers actually are in support of it, and it actually makes sound economic sense, and is in part a reaction to the cuts that are occurring at the state level because the federal government is shirking its responsibility in order to give more and more resources away to people at the top? No, of course they didn't publish that. And so, you know, luckily we have a nice, strong, independent journalism outfit in Maine, the Maine Morning Star, where we were able to get that piece printed. But I think this is the point, again, coming back to Vanessa's research, my read on this at some level is, historically, over time, the rich have always been concerned about the masses rising up and taking their piece of the pie. And they use that concern to undercut what's available to the masses and how we structure our economy and structure our government. And the flip side of that, though, is that if they go too far with it, eventually the masses get hip to that and they say, wait a second, this structure, these rules actually don't make any sense. And I think that's part of what we're starting to see is we've been on 50-year march in this country of radically restructuring the rules, disinvesting in government, allowing, you know, businesses to run amok, and gutting our tax code and the resources available. And it's starting to come home to roost for people. People now increasingly are having to compensate for the absence of government services and resources. They're having to compensate for the fact that they're not getting paid at the same level that they would if they had more power to negotiate better wages, which are being undercut at this point. Again, they're feeling that pressure. And I think we're in a moment where there is a movement building to change the rules.
Okay, so I just want to sneak in one question before I bring this to wrap up. What about wealth flight? This whole thing of the millionaires tax in California and the rich people threatening to move to Texas, like, is that a thing, Vanessa?
The best book I would direct you to on the question of whether there is millionaire tax flight is a book called The Myth of Millionaire Tax Flight.
Okay, not true.
Which kind of gives away the conclusion. But, you know, it's really helpful to remember, right? So there are two things to remember here. One, I think sometimes very wealthy people like to sort of act as though they are the engine of economic growth. That is not true. The engine of economic growth is regular people. And so you, the fact that one rich person moves away is not it actually that fundamentally that important to the structure of the economy. But the reality is they don't move that much. And if you look at interstate travel on these things, and there are people are always threatening to do so, you know. But what actually happens is that, yes, sometimes when people get old, they move to Florida. This is a true fact. They moved to Florida for more than one reason, right? And that is an ongoing phenomenon. But by and large, people don't move because of tax at the top. They don't move because of high tax rates, because they're embedded in communities, right? Yeah. You know, they are typically older people. They've lived somewhere a long time, and they don't want to move. The people who you lose, right, when we're thinking about how the government policy affects who moves, it's often young people. Young people starting families move to places where they can afford to buy a house or go to, you know, send their kids to school. So, yeah, that's not what I would consider a serious concern.
Okay, sorry to cut this off. This is so fascinating. We could go on for another 90 minutes, but we are running out of time, and I promised you to put your final thoughts on. And we didn't get to what can we do, what should we do. So if you could wrap us up with some citizen participation thoughts. Go ahead, Garrett, take your minute.
I think we've shown in the state, and that when people, when voters, when the electorate rises up and says, we want more from our government and we want it to be rendered fairly, that we can make progress. We've shown that through our history. At the same time, we have to be vigilant. We are very susceptible to being pitted against each other in ways that ultimately benefit those who are not in that fight. We're in this moment in this country that I think is a real inflection point. And unless and until people understand that the concerns they have about our democracy, about their own livelihoods, about their ability to meet their daily needs are tied to this conversation about our tax code and our tax policy and who's winning and who's losing, we are going to be in dire straits. But I think people are understanding it, and I see signs of progress.
Vanessa, final thoughts.
So, you know, I'm going to bring it back to where we started. The Supreme Court in 1895 declared quite unexpectedly that an income tax was unconstitutional. Now, we'd had an income tax to help pay for the Civil War. It's part of the reason that the United States won the Civil War, because we could raise enough money. It was the Confederacy really struggled with that. But they decided a very similar tax was suddenly unconstitutional because they're worried about a war of the poor against the rich. And this seemed like the end of the income tax. But 20 years later, we had our income tax back again. And the reason for that is because there was a state-by-state-by-state campaign to bring it back, right? That we were going to reduce tariffs so that we have an income tax. We were going to tax J.D. Rockefeller. We were going to make this country a fairer place. And that was on the back of populist and progressive farmers across this country. And I think that you're right. We're at an inflection point. And I think that we have a lot in our history we can learn from as we, you know, as we try and make those changes to make ourselves, again, a stronger and more equal country.
I can't thank you both enough. That's our show for today. Thank you to our guest this afternoon, Garrett Martin, President and CEO of the Maine Center for Economic Policy, and Vanessa Williamson, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at Brookings and a Senior Fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. She's the author of the book, The Price of Democracy. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. We're streaming at WERU.org. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@WERU.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is lwvme.org for more information, articles about this topic, or to learn more about other shows in the series. You can also subscribe to our podcast at lwvme.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next month when we're going to talk about the role of a professional, nonpartisan civil service in delivering the services that our taxes pay for. Thanks again.